Welcome to Oncology Today, a special edition focused on key presentations in genitourinary cancers from the 2023 ASCO meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Raina McKay from the UC San Diego Moores Cancer Center in La Jolla, California. To begin, I asked her to present and comment on some of the key presentations from the recent ASCO meeting focused on prostate cancer.
Hi, everyone. My name is Raina McKay, and I'm a GU medical oncologist at the University of California in San Diego. Pleasure to be with you today and really highlighting genitourinary highlights from ASCO 2023. We're going to go through a rapid fire of discussing updates in prostate cancer, kidney cancer, urinary tract tumors, and then we'll kind of end with some closing updates. So stay with us as we kind of do this rapid fire of key abstracts from ASCO. So first, we're going to start with prostate cancer. And what I'll highlight first is the data that were presented by Dr. Bossi, the results of the PEACE 1 phase 3 randomized trial. And really what this analysis did was look at the patients who received radiation to the primary in the context of PEACE 1. So this is the design of the PEACE 1 study. It was a study for patients with de novo metastatic hormone sensitive prostate cancer. Patients needed to have distant metastases. And the trial randomized patients 1:1:1:1 to standard of care versus standard of care plus ABI or standard of care plus radiotherapy versus standard of care plus ABI plus radiotherapy. In the context of the conduct of this study, while the study was accruing, the approval, docetaxel was approved for the treatment of metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. So while this study wasn't necessarily initially designed to assess the question of what is the role of triple therapy, it evolved into that question because the standard of care changed in the context of the trial conduct. And so this study does answer the question of what's sort of the role of the addition of abiraterone to the backbone of ADT docetaxel as the standard of care evolved. So here were the top line data that were presented on radiographic progression-free survival and overall survival for patients with low volume metastatic disease. And you can see here from the Kaplan-Meier curve for PFS that really for those patients that were receiving the standard of care plus ABI, that's the top two lines of this KM curve, the addition of radiation to the primary did in fact significantly improve RPFS. It seems that the effect of radiation to the primary without the utilization of abiraterone, those curves are almost overlapping. So the effect was really in those people who were escalated. And it's unclear, how to totally apply this data and put it in context of data from Stampede, where the backbone there was ADT docetaxel. When we look at the overall survival, there are certainly trends when we look at the hazard ratios for overall survival for radiation to the primary. With a hazard ratio here of 0.81. But again, this was really not necessarily a statistically significant difference that was seen, but certainly a difference in RPFS. So I do think this data kind of highlights the continued potential role of radiation to the primary or treatment to the primary for those patients with metastatic disease. Next, what I'm going to highlight here is the ENZADA trial. This was a small study that looked at enzalutamide, docetaxel, and ADT for patients with metastatic castration-sensitive prostate cancer. We certainly have other larger data sets from Enzamet and other trials that have looked at the combination of enzalutamide, docetaxel, plus ADT for CSPC. But nonetheless, I think this trial demonstrated that there's significant PSA responses. You can see that in the serologic response that's designated PSA response with the combination therapy, with this triple therapy regimen, if you will. The sample size for this study was 36 patients, and you could see the patients with a complete response at 75%. Additionally, we have the KM curves. It's a single arm phase 2 study, so I think it's hard to put time to event endpoints in the context of the smaller study with time to events, but certainly data supporting the combination of triple therapy where the ARSI is enzalutamide. Next, we'll highlight TALAPRO 2. The initial data from TALAPRO 2 were presented at GU ASCO in 2023, and we saw data that were presented at ASCO this year by Dr. Kareem Fazazi on the HRR deficient population. I think in the initial data were really presented for all comer, and now we're getting data for the HRR deficient. This study included patients that had metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, its first-line CRPC. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to talazoparib plus enzalutamide versus placebo plus enzalutamide. And the primary endpoint was radiographic progression-free survival. So this analysis is really predicated on those individuals that are known to have HRR mutations. And what we saw was in patients who had known HRR mutations, the benefit of enzalutamide plus talazoparib was really dramatic for RPFS. The hazard ratio here is 0.45. You can see the data for overall survival as well, 0.69, the hazard ratio there of the combination versus placebo plus enzalutamide, and even more dramatic for those patients that had BRCA alterations at 0.61 that we see here. When there was subgroup analysis that was conducted based on HRR mutation type, and you could see with this forest plot that the degree of benefit of the combination therapy was really most pronounced for those patients with BRCA1, BRCA2 alterations, followed by PALB2. We did actually see an effect for CDK12. I know there's been controversy around some of these other HRR genes, whether they are truly predictive of response to PARP inhibition. But I think this forest plot really highlights sort of the degree of benefit across these different mutation groups. And lastly, I think it's key to highlight the treatment-related adverse events and quality of life. The biggest adverse events that are seen with this combination include fatigue and anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, clearly with the PARP inhibitor causing more cytopenias across the board. Most of these were lower grade. The anemia, you could see the degree of a grade 3 or higher anemia that's highlighted on this tornado plot. And then the last thing that I think is worthwhile highlighting is the impact of this regimen with regards to quality of life. And they looked at, the time to definitive clinically meaningful deterioration in quality of life between the two arms. And it was, in fact, that the combination of talazoparib and enzalutamide was associated with a longer time to deterioration in quality of life. The hazard ratio here is 0.69. I think this is important data, when we think about using combination regimens in the clinic. All right, so the next abstract that I want to highlight is an abstract that was presented by David Olmos that was looking at the prognostic significance of HRR mutations and specifically BRCA mutations for patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer that were receiving first-line therapy. This was data that was from the CAPTURE study design. You can see that there's a lot of studies that actually were combined into this data set that was evaluated in the context of this analysis. So it was, the pro-repair study, the PROSTAX study with the various treatment arms here. So all of these kind of data sets comprise this CAPTURE cohort that were analyzed, and they looked at RPFS to first-line mCRPC therapy, PFS2 and overall survival. You can see the gene panel here that defined the HRR gene alterations, including ATM, BRCA1/2, and various others that have been classically utilized to define HRR positivity. And what we can see is that for patients who are BRCA1/2 versus non-BRCA, that there actually is a decrease in overall progression-free survival. I should say that's the top panel when patients have a BRCA1/2 alteration. So BRCA1/2 alterations are associated with decreased RPFS and also overall survival. That's the figure on the right here. And on the bottom panel, you can also see the breakdown of BRCA 1-2 versus non-BRCA in each of these different KM curves. Neil, you had a question to highlight.
Yeah, just to clarify, this is sort of like the natural history. It's not with PARP. Is that right?
That's correct. This is the natural history. It's not just with a PARP. It's just first-line mCRPC patients that have a BRCA alteration. Do they do better or worse? And really trying to understand what is the prognostic significance of these alterations in these different contexts.
And the global thing here is that the BRCA patients did worse?
That's correct. You know, I think if you look at this kind of graphic on the, not the KM curve, the graphic on the right, it takes the all-comer population. And you could see that the median RPFS is 9.8 months and PFS2 is 15.4 and overall survival at 26.1. And then when you break this down by BRCA, HRR non-BRCA versus non-BRCA, you can see the median overall survival, 18.35 months for BRCA mutated, 21.9 for non-BRCA HRR, and 28.1 for non-BRCA, gene alterations. So it kind of the non-HRR group, if you will.
You know, in other cancers, you hear a lot about platinum chemotherapy for patients with BRCA. What do we know about that in prostate cancer?
There are certainly data sets that have looked at platinum chemotherapy for patients with HRR mutated disease. We just don't have large, phase three data. We have, smaller data from phase two studies where, there's enhanced sensitivity to platinums for patients that have HRR gene alterations, specifically BRCA1-2, but we don't necessarily have large phase three trials. And the larger trials that were conducted, 10, 20 years ago, did not at all stratify by HRR status. There was a series of trials that looked at sort of what's the role of carboplatin and mCRPC. Most of those studies were ultimately negative, and that's probably because they were just all-comer unselected population.
Just out of curiosity, outside a clinical trial, if you have a patient, let's say, with a BRCA2 germline mutation, do you treat them any differently if they have first hormone-sensitive metastatic disease?
So very good question. I think that in the metastatic hormone sensitive setting, there is no role right now for a PARP inhibitor. I think because of the fact that BRCA alterations are associated with more negative outcomes, there could be a predilection to want to escalate therapy for those individuals. Instead of just giving them ADT and an ARSI, maybe there's going to be a predilection to want to give them docetaxel, especially if they fit the diagnosis of, high volume disease by or high risk disease by latitude or charted criteria. So, but I don't think right now there are data to support the use of PARP inhibitors in MHSPC, though there are several trials, TALAPRO-3, Amplitude, that are looking at the role of PARP inhibitors in selected patients in the MHSPC setting.
I don't imagine you want to wager any money on what they're going to see in the BRCA patients.
I would probably guess that those trials are going to be positive, especially if there's an enrichment of the BRCA1-2 individuals. Like I would, if we learn from the use of these agents in ovarian and breast cancer, almost in every context where you're escalating therapy with a PARP inhibitor for a mutated patient, we've demonstrated that it's resulted in improved outcomes. So I think if we want to mirror, just learning from other disease settings, I suspect that we would potentially see an effect, though we have to obviously wait for the data.
No, I mean, I know there are trials and, quote, yes, we need to wait for the data. I just think it must be kind of hard to be looking at a patient with a BRCA germline mutation in that situation and not give them PARP inhibitor if they got metastatic disease, but we'll see. I guess we'll see what the trials show and what you all do then. Please continue.
So moving on, the next study that I want to highlight is the very innovative LuPARP study, which this was a phase one trial that was looking at the combination of lutetium PSMA plus olaparib for patients with metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. This was a really elegantly designed study that was looking at varying doses of olaparib given on at different doses and also on a different schedule in combination with lutetium PSMA. This was a standard 3+3 dose escalation strategy. It was designed for patients with mCRPC who are post an ARSI and post a docetaxel with good organ function that did have PSMA positive disease by PET imaging and no FDG discordance. And initially, the dosing cohorts looked at giving olaparib on day 2 to 15 of each 6-week cycle. And then in the later cohorts, cohort 7, 8, and 9, they looked at dosing, minus 7 and 14 days of the cycle and minus 4 and 14 days of the cycle and minus 4 and 18 days of the cycle. The primary endpoint was defining the recommended phase 2 dosing for olaparib when given in a combination with lutetium PSMA. There was also a dose expansion as well. And these were the top line data. I think if we look at the different cohorts across the board and the key AEs of special interest, I would say are the cytopenias, looking at the rates of anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia. And, the rates of higher grade toxicity was actually quite limited. You can see here a little bit of grade 3 anemia, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia that was seen at cohort 5, which is at 250 milligrams BID dosing days 2 through 15. And a little bit that was seen in cohort 6. And then with the staggered dosing at day minus, 4 to 14 or minus 4 to 18, kind of less toxicity that was seen. So, it seemed to be that with this intermittent dosing of the PARP inhibitor as opposed to continuous dosing of the PARP inhibitor during the entire lutetium treatment time, they were able to mitigate tox. And here are the, PSA response and swimmer plots. This is still early days. This was obviously the dose finding study, but definitely seeing, dramatic PSA response across the dosing cohorts seems to be most pronounced with dosing cohorts, 5, 6, and 7, as you can sort of see here. And, here they also integrated CTC dynamics in the context of LuPARP and looked at dynamic changes in CTC profiles and demonstrated declines in CTCs that seem to kind of correspond with PSMA PET imaging and PSA response. So I think this is really a provocative trial looking at the combination of, olaparib and lutetium PSMA. This is in an unselected population, kind of capitalizing on the mechanism of action of PARP inhibitors and the DNA damage that's done with beta radiotherapy inducing single-strand DNA breaks that then cannot be repaired given the PARP inhibition being on board. And so the next study that I want to highlight is a study that was kind of developed from the VISION trial. This abstract basically looked at developing a predictive model for lutetium PSMA from VISION. And in the context of this model that was designed, they looked at a series of factors to develop a nomogram that was predictive of overall survival, radiographic progression-free survival, and also PSA response that integrated, opioid use, AST levels, hemoglobin levels, lymphocyte count, some of the historic Halabi criteria that have been known to be prognostic, but also other factors such as, PSMA positivity in lymph nodes, LDH, ALK-FOS, and based off of, the presence or absence of these variables, there's a nomogram to predict 12-month, survival, RPFS, and also probability of achieving a PSA 50.
Just a couple of questions. For the LuPARP study, did they look at whether or not they had HRR mutations and whether they benefited, or is this too early?
I think that some of that analysis is certainly ongoing. I don't believe that there was a full-fledged kind of breakout of all of the different patients and their biomarker status, though I believe that that's probably going to be forthcoming.
I would think so, too. Also, in terms of the PREDICT study, that's looking at predicting whether you benefit from lutetium?
Correct. So this this was presented as a poster, not as an oral abstract. And so there wasn't too much sort of pictures, if you will, from poster. But yeah.
So, but up to now, clinically, are there predictors of benefit that have been used or that you use?
At the present time.
I guess the one thing, what about degree of PSMA act positivity?
So I think the maybe at last year's ASCO, there was data that were presented looking at SUV max and SUV mean from a PSMA PET, if that was predictive of outcomes. And it actually seemed like the SUV max was not all that predictive, but rather SUV mean. The problem with SUV mean is it's not something that's readily reported out by a nuclear medicine radiologist at the time that the scan is done. So I think these are markers that I think are going to continue to be looked at. And is there some sort of SUV threshold or using the PSMA PET imaging to actually think about that as a predictive biomarker of response?
You know, what about just like, I mean, you can look at these scans and sort of go, well, it's really picking up a lot, you know, sort of visually. Do you take that? I've heard people talk about kind of taking that into account. Do you do that?
I mean, I think you have to, but I think we do. But there, I guess I want to say is people that have a very high disease burden, that have widespread like metastatic disease that's just like lighting up, right? Those people may just be in a different category than somebody that's low volume with visible disease. Like they just find the low volume patient may just do better just because they're a low volume patient, though the therapy may still work for them. Like, you know what I mean? I think you have to you know, so you could say like, oh yeah, it's like the scan is so positive, they're going to have a great response, but it's also so positive. Like they've got a lot of disease. They've got a lot of disease burden.
Right.
I almost want to say like, you know, I suspect that what may drive response is actually the heterogeneity of the tumors that are there. Cause this is a directed therapy against PSMA, expressing tumors. And if there's a lot of heterogeneous disease, and admixed populations of cells that just don't express PSMA, I suspect that's where people may or patients may not necessarily do as well. Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. All right, please continue.
All right, so those were all of our prostate cancer updates. A lot of really exciting data that got presented. And next, I think we're going to move into kidney cancer. And probably this was, if I had to pick sort of the top study that was presented at the meeting, potentially practice-changing study that was presented at the meeting, it would be the CONTACT-3 trial that was presented by Dr. Tony Shaweri at ASCO. This was a very important study that looked at the combination of atezolizumab plus cabozantinib versus cabozantinib alone in patients who had metastatic or advanced RCC, and it allowed patients to enroll if they were clear cell or non-clear cell, but patients had to have progression on a prior checkpoint inhibitor. And there's various criteria that were used to define what that actually meant, and the immune checkpoint criteria inhibitor had to be in their most immediate preceding line of therapy. And I think in clinical practice, a lot of individuals may want to layer in therapies at the time of progression on IO therapy, sort of not abandoning the IO completely. So this study looked at asking, well, do we continue the IO agent and layer in, or do we switch? And the primary endpoint was PFS and overall survival. And, you know, top line data, this was a negative trial. The RPFS curves are completely overlapping. There was no benefit in RPFS with continuing the IO agent with the TKI versus just doing the TKI alone. And when you look at the subgroup analyses for PFS, really by age, sex, you know, region, histology, you know, IMDC risk, their prior response to the immune checkpoint inhibitor, there was no real subgroup that really stood out as being, oh yeah, potentially there could be a signal there. Additionally, there was increased toxicity associated with combination therapy compared to single agent. So I think, you know, in the discussion from David Braun on this, study, you know, this is really a strategy that is not, you know, should not be employed in clinical practice. There's another study called the TiNivo 2 trial, which we may talk about a little bit later, but is looking at the role of nivolumab plus tivozanib versus tivozanib alone in patients who had progressed on a prior checkpoint inhibitor. I think that study will be really important. One of the criticisms of this trial was that it included atezolizumab, which is a PD-L1 targeting monoclonal antibody, and this agent right now is not FDA approved as a monotherapy or a combination therapy in RCC. I think what was also quite striking from this trial was just how well the cabozantinib patients did. I mean, we look at the second line RPFS data with Cabo, 10.8 months. That's very, very impressive to see that in the modern era. Additionally, we don't present it on this slide, but the response data, like the primary PD rate, you know, patients not responding to Cabo alone, even in the control arm, was less than 10% in the refractory setting. So I think this really kind of also highlights just how good of a drug cabozantinib is. Yep.
So the Nivo plus TiVo study, is that in patients also who've had prior IOs or just
Correct.
The first line?
Correct. That's a study looking...
Is it also being looked at in first line or just in second line?
Very good question. So it is not being looked at in first line. That study is designed in patients who had seen a prior immunotherapy agent progressing on that agent and then randomized to receive continued nivolumab or plus TiVo versus TiVo alone.
You know, one thing I only started to really think about recently was, you know, with all these TKI IO combinations, how much the TKI affects quality of life. You know, kind of, I'm starting to think that in a way, almost like when you give it as monotherapy, you see a difference in side effects between the different TKIs. And I guess it's sort of obvious, but I kind of more recently appreciated that even in these, am I right in saying that? That
yeah.
Even in the combinations, sort of the TKI toxicity still kind of comes out and is differentiated. And I don't know, have you used TiVo? Because I hear people saying it's better tolerated and the data sort yeah. of suggests that, but do you have that impression?
I do. I mean, I think tivozanib is a very potent VEGF inhibitor and it does not have too much off target effects, if you will, outside of VEGF. And so I think this is, one of the biggest side effects is hypertension. We certainly see that with tivozanib, but I think the hand foot syndrome, the diarrhea, tend to be a little bit more manageable with tivozanib, you know, if we look at the data. But, you know, none of these TKIs have really been compared head to head. We're doing kind of cross trial comparisons of like, this was the AE profile from this study. This was the AE profile from this study. So, and certainly when they're used in combinations, the data look different. I think the other thing that's important when we look at quality of life is, I think this even more relevant for the first line setting is how much is the patient's quality of life limited by their disease related symptoms? Because if you have an effective drug and something is very, very symptomatic from the disease, a lot of times you'll see improvement. But if you have a patient population where that patient population is largely asymptomatic or includes a large favorable risk group, then you may see decrement because those patients may be not even symptomatic at baseline, you know?
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about. Okay, please continue.
All right. So next study that was presented that I want to highlight is a study abstract that was presented by Dr. Brian Reaney. This is now 5-year follow-up data from KEYNOTE-426. I think we've all been kind of eagerly awaiting the results of the long-term follow-up data from the IO VEGF combinations for RCC. We've certainly seen data of long-term follow-up and efficacy and durability from CheckMate 214, which was a study of nivolumab plus ipilimumab. And now we're kind of beginning to see the long-term follow-up from these other IO-VEGF trials. So just as a reminder, KEYNOTE-426 was a study that enrolled patients with newly diagnosed or recurrent stage 4 RCC that hadn't received prior therapy. Patients were randomized 1:1 to receive pembro plus axitinib, with the pembro discontinuing at the two-year mark versus sunitinib given on a 4 week on, 2 week off schedule, with a primary endpoint of RPFS and OS in the intent to treat population, which included all comers by IMDC risk criteria. And so here is the top line data for the overall cohort on the top panel. So the top panel is RPFS in the intent to treat population. The hazard ratio continues to look good over time at 0.69. It's kind of trending upward over time with each follow-up analysis. I think one of the biggest questions is long-term durability of IO-VEGF. And I think there's a question of whether we are seeing a tail on the curve, tail on the PFS curve, compared to what we see with IO-IO. And I think it's hard to sort of really understand the long-term durability potential for even cure with IO-VEGF therapies. With regards to the overall survival, you know, clearly over time, the overall survival has there has been a benefit with subsequent analyses. The hazard ratio here does also continue to drift upward. It's at 0.84 over time, probably related to the fact that these patients may go on to continue to receive second and third line therapy, which can affect the OS readout. You can see the breakdown on the bottom panel by risk group. So favorable risk, here on the left, and intermediate and poor risk on the right. Really, the intermediate and poor risk patients seem to derive the most pronounced benefit from this regimen, with OS and RPFS hazard ratios of less than one. I think there's some continued controversy around the role of these regimens for favorable risk patients, the hazard ratio kind of drifting at 1.1 for overall survival over time. I think in the modern era, though, I would probably argue that use of single agent VEGF inhibition has really fallen by the wayside.
How would you sort of answer your own question about the plateau that we're seeing here, if any, compared to what you see with Ipi/Nivo? I know it's indirect, but what's your impression about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think with the RPFS from Nivo-Ipi, if we look at the intent to treat population, the plateau begins to emerge right around 18 to 24 months and is really holding steady right around 30% with continued long-term follow-up and over 5 years of follow-up. And so there's a question of whether we're truly seeing that here. Maybe there's a little bit of a plateau, but, you know, obviously at the tail end of this curve beyond the 5 year mark, there's a lot of censoring that's currently happening. You see all those tick marks that are there. So I think in my mind, I don't know that we've proven the long-term durability of IO-VEGF yet, but I think, you know, we'll have to see over time.
Right now, is it your general preference to use Ipi/Nivo in patients who, let's say, are not highly symptomatic?
That is my preference. I think to use Nivo-Ipi if patients don't need an immediate cytoreduction. You know, it's interesting from the discussion that was presented at ASCO, also from David Braun on this very topic, there was data from a KC Cure patient survey about what are the things that matter most for patients when being treated for advanced or metastatic RCC. And actually, one of the number one things that helped, that kind of was a decision maker for patients, was cure. Patients want to be cured. They want to have a highly effective therapy. And, you know, there's a lot of things on the list from side effects, cost, you know, various other factors, patient-related factors that may be at play with a clinical decision, with clinical decision making. But I think the number one on the list was efficacy and potential for cure. And, you know, I think that tends to be the reason why I lean towards IO-IO when I can. Most people want to play the long game if they have the luxury to be able to make that decision. Some people don't have the choice. They have to play the short game. And if you have to play the short game, IO-VEGF is a wonderful, highly effective strategy. PD rates less than 10%, high response rates, great PFS. Like, you can't go wrong. People will respond. They're going to do well. But it's just long-term durability.
Any trials or strategies out there to start out with VEGF TKI and then flip over to anti-CTLA-4 PD-1?
So I'm going to flip that question. There have been a series of adaptive trials that have looked at starting with Nevo and then layering in the CTLA-4 right. later, where they get mm-hmm. an IO agent and then they layer it in later. These trials were not done looking at IO-VEGF combinations, but just IO by itself. And actually, when we look at these trials in aggregate, it was the Omnivore trial, a trial led by Mike Atkins through HCRN, and the Titan RCC trial, a European study. In aggregate, these trials demonstrated a low rate of PR-CR conversions if you are just doing this adaptive strategy. And oftentimes, many patients were not actually able to receive the CTLA-4 inhibitor for one reason or another, whether it be toxicity or disease progression. And so the conversion rate was low. So I think in aggregate from these studies, we've learned that this adaptive strategy probably doesn't make sense, that you're compromising on efficacy by doing that.
All right, please continue.
All right, so the next study to present is data that were presented by Tom Hudson on the final pre-specified OS from CLEAR, very similar to sort of what I just highlighted from KEYNOTE-426 of sort of longer-term follow-up with frontline IO-VEGF for patients with advanced clear cell RCC. This study randomized patients to one of three arms, lenvatinib pembrolizumab, lenvatinib everolimus versus sunitinib. And here we see the final overall survival analysis for the comparison of len-pem versus sunitinib. Hazard ratio at 0.79, so definitely continued to demonstrate benefit over time. But we see that hazard ratio drift upwards over time. And then if you look at the different subgroups across the board, it's particularly looking at the favorable, intermediate, and poor risk groups. For the final OS analysis, you can see that there does appear to be a benefit across all risk groups over time with this agent or with this combination. And the other analysis that I thought was quite interesting to look at was to correlate the correlation of depth of response with overall survival and breaking down that PR group into those patients that had greater than 75% shrinkage of their target lesions versus those that were less than that. And, those patients that had greater than 75% shrinkage of their target lesions seemed to really track with those patients that had a CR. So those deep PRs and CRs seemed to do kind of quite well. The next study that I wanted to highlight was a study of CBM-588, and CBM is a live bacterial product that contains Clostridium butycidium. This was the phase 1 study of nivolumab plus cabozantinib with or without CBM-588. So I think we need to kind of take this data for a little bit of a grain of salt. This was not a large trial, included a small number of patients, single institute study. The primary endpoint of the trial was looking at the abundance of gut microbial populations, specifically the Bifidobacterium, which has been associated with a kind of more favorable gut microbiome. The study was negative for its primary endpoint. It did not demonstrate that there were substantial differences in the gut microbial populations when CBM was used with the backbone of nivo-cabo. But when we look at the efficacy data, there did appear to be a signal of PFS that was not reached with the combination versus 5.8 months with nivo-cabo alone. And then when we look at the response rate, 56% versus 25%. I think one of the biggest criticisms of this data are, one, it's a single institution data set. The trial was open label, so it wasn't blinded. And when we look at the efficacy parameters, the control is really underperforming compared to what we see in clinical trials. I mean, frontline Nivo-Cabo PFS is upwards of 18 months. And so here it's 5.8 months. And similarly, the objective response rate is greater than 50% just with the control, just with Nivo-Cabo from CheckMate 9ER. So I think it's a small study. It's signal finding, hypothesis generating. So we need to take it for a grain of salt.
So I'm not sure how deeply you're into the research in this area. Some people really get excited about it. But just to understand, so they gave this back live product, and it actually, they could demonstrate that it actually changed the type of bacteria in the bowel. Is that right?
Well, they actually did not. So they did give the product. The primary endpoint was to see if the gut bacteria did change to a more favorable gut microbiota, and it did not. So those are those two curves here, looking at baseline and week 12, baseline and week 12, and they looked at on treatment change in the microbiota to a more favorable, milieu, if you will, and those comparisons were not really significant. Now, there's probably a lot of reasons for that. Is it sample size? Is it the right agent they were looking at? Are there other agents that need to be looked at? Is it a group of agents, group of species that need to be looked at? But the trial did not actually meet its primary endpoint for being able to augment the gut microbial populations when they were specifically looking at the bifido bacterium.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of seems a little simplistic to think that you could, take this orally and it's really going to work. But are there other data that kind of strategy actually works, that at least change the bacteria?
Yeah, there are other, data sets. I think colorectal cancers and other tumors were kind of favorable probiotics were able to augment the microbiota within the stool and other, there's certainly been a lot of work that's been done in melanoma as well, even looking at fecal transplantation and other very provocative. I think that this field is incredibly complex, but you're right that it's a little bit simplistic to think of it in this kind of way. But I think this is definitely something that is worthy of further exploration. It also builds upon data where we've demonstrated in kidney cancer that the use of antibiotics in the context of IO therapy has been associated with worse outcomes. And so there's clearly something there that we just don't understand. But I think the biggest thing is, how can we therapeutically capitalize on that?
Yeah, that was the other thing I was going to ask you. I mean, I don't know how often you really have the opportunity to vary what you do in terms of using antibiotics. But do you try to avoid antibiotics in people on IOs?
I think at the end of the day, I think if somebody needs it, they need it. I don't think that we tend to use a lot of more prophylactic or sort of like, I think treating, if somebody has an infection, it's important to treat them, or you have a high suspicion that they may have an infection, it's important to kind of treat them with what they need. And it's probably that there's somewhat of a bias, even though these analyses were controlling for a lot of multifactorial variables, these analyses that looked at antibiotics, but you could almost envision that somebody who's going to be receiving antibiotics just in general may be sicker. And even though you've corrected for a lot of variables and your multivariable analysis include, but it's hard to kind of really correct for everything. And so there are some biases to these retrospective analyses that looked at sort of the role of antibiotics with IO therapy and RCC.
All right, please continue.
All right, so the next study to present is now kind of, we talked a lot about the metastatic setting. We're going to kind of shift gears into the adjuvant setting. We saw data from ESMO 2022 of top-line data from CheckMate 914. This was a trial that looked at adjuvant nivolumab plus ipilimumab versus placebo for patients with RCC that was at high risk of recurrence post-nephrectomy. And so now we're seeing the subgroup analyses from that trial that were presented by Dr. Motzer. For part A of this trial, we're not going to go into part B because the data from part B haven't yet been presented, but for part A, it looked at the combination of nivo-ipi versus placebo with a primary endpoint of disease-free survival by independent review with other key secondary endpoints there, overall survival and safety. And these were the top line data of DFS by subgroups. And really, I think the subgroups of interest for me that kind of were pulled out from this data set are those patients that had sarcomatoid RCC. They really seem to derive great benefit from nivo-ipi, and the hazard ratio there is 0.29. There wasn't a lot of these patients that were enrolled on the trial, only, you know, about, you know, less than 50 patients with sarcomatoid features that were identified, but those patients really seemed to derive the most benefit from this regimen. Additionally, what was quite provocative, and it, you know, I think this may be something that may be worthwhile trying to explore further, is those tumors that were PD-L1 positive, those tumors really did seem to respond better to therapy versus not. The hazard ratio here was at 0.40 for those tumors that were PD-L1 positive. You could see the curves really, they splay apart really quite nicely. And you would, could almost imagine, like, is it worthwhile conducting this trial again in a biomarker selected population? I don't know if that's going to happen. You know, there's a clear signal here that's likely worth investigating further.
Just kind of curious what your thoughts are about this study and what it means and why we didn't see more benefit.
You know, I think that this was an interesting study. There's a lot of factors here, from the patient population that was enrolled. This study, I don't believe, enrolled M1 NED patients. And so those were a high-risk population. I think there was more T1 tumors that were enrolled. So one is, you want to ensure that the patient population that's enrolling is of high enough risk that they're going to derive benefit from that therapy. I think item two is, you know, thinking about the toxicity in the adjuvant setting may be different than the toxicity in the metastatic setting. And somebody's threshold to put up with a certain amount of toxicity may be different in the adjuvant setting versus the advanced setting. And we saw this in the TKI era when we did a lot of the TKI trials, that in many of the TKI studies, the starting dose of the TKI needed to be decreased compared to standard dosing that we use in the metastatic disease. I think the tolerance and AE profile may be a little bit different. Now, the nivo-ipi that was given here was given on a little bit different schedule than what we do in the metastatic setting. Instead of doing the ipi every 3 weeks, the ipi was actually done every 6 weeks, and the duration of therapy was only for 6 months. But you know, there was a lot of, I think, drop off along the way of people being able to receive all four doses of ipi. So I think that also could have potentially impacted, you know, things. So, you know, the other thing about immunotherapy, there was a very provocative trial in melanoma through SWOG that looked at adjuvant versus neoadjuvant immunotherapy. And there seemed to be a more dramatic effect when the same regimen was given in the neoadjuvant setting as opposed to the adjuvant setting. And I think there's some thought around, like, is the adjuvant strategy the best strategy for IO-based therapy? Or, like, do you need tumor there? Do you need antigen there to kind of mount a certain response? I think those are questions to be determined. You know, certainly the PROSPER trial did include a perioperative approach, but I wouldn't label that trial as a neoadjuvant trial. That trial basically gave patients one dose of Nevo 3 to 4 weeks before surgery and then took them to surgery, and then they got the remaining, you know, 9 months of Nevo post-op. So it wasn't truly neoadjuvant, where the bulk of the treatment was given in the neoadjuvant setting, you know, or 3 months or somewhere on that order. But, you know, I think we're still figuring things out in the adjuvant setting for RCC.
Yeah, Georgina Long in melanoma, and that's one of the things I really want to ask her, because I don't remember seeing in other, like breast cancer, other solid tumors, that differential that you just described, where you really got more effect, you know, in the neoadjuvant, that whole neoantigen thing, et cetera. That was really amazing.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah. All
right. She told me about that a couple of years ago, and now that the data's out, I'm like, whoa, that is amazing.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
Yeah.
Please continue.
It's exciting. It's provocative. I think what's cool about the neoadjuvant setting, it allows you to have real-time in vivo assessment of the response of your treatment. And it opens up the door to think about surrogate biomarkers from a pathology standpoint for, like, approvals. Like in breast cancer, like PATH, CR, residual cancer burden have been surrogate biomarkers of survival that have led to expedited drug approvals. And so I think there's a lot of excitement around the neoadjuvant setting, you know?
Right. Yeah. I guess the other thing, though, when the thing, again, that kind of gets me confused, you know, breast cancer, they're using chemo hormones, but like there was another neoadjuvant IO lung study presented at ASCO that was positive. But again, it didn't look that much different. I mean, then when you give it adjuvantly, they didn't really look at that question, but it wasn't very dramatic from what I saw. So again, melanoma seems to be standing out. I wonder if you would see it in renal if you looked at it. Mm-hmm. I don't be really interesting. All right, please continue.
So the next study to highlight is the SWOG 0931 study. This was a study that was conducted looking at adjuvant everolimus post-nephrectomy. Patients received 54 weeks of treatment. It enrolled patients who had RCC within 12 weeks of their nephrectomy. It did include a wide range of patients, you know, even those with T1B disease, if they had grade 3 or 4 tumors. It did include patients with non-clear cell histology and didn't allow patients that had metastatic disease to enroll. The study, was a negative trial. It did not result in a statistically significant improvement in, recurrence-free survival with everolimus compared to placebo. What was presented here are subset analyses for those patients with clear cell disease and also those patients with non-clear cell disease. They also presented, the subset of patients with papillary and chromophobe histologies. These are the disease-free survival curves on the bottom here. What's on the left is the papillary. What's on the right is the chromophobe. And, you know, there was really no difference in disease-free survival or even really overall survival in these groups. Hazard ratio for the chromophobes trended a little bit better, 0.89, 0.93 for DFS and OS respectively. But, in essence, there's really no role for everolimus in the adjuvant setting in renal cell carcinoma. And some would argue that there really is no role for single agent everolimus in the metastatic setting either, given where the field has sort of shifted. All right. So now we're kind of moving off of kidney and moving into the urinary tract tumors. A lot of exciting data that were presented in bladder cancer and sort of urinary tract diseases. I'll highlight here the overall survival data by response with first-line induction treatment with atezolizumab and a platinum gemcitabine versus placebo plus platinum gemcitabine. This is data from the IMvigor 130 trial that were presented by Enrique Grande. Just to kind of give a overview of the trial design, IMvigor 130 was a trial that enrolled patients with locally advanced or metastatic urothelial cancer that had received no prior systemic therapy. Patients had a good performance status, did include patients with an ECOG of up to 2, and patients had to be eligible for first-line platinum-based chemotherapy. That doesn't just mean cisplatinum. Cisplatinum or carboplatin was allowed in the context of this study. And then, patients were randomized to one of three arms, atezo plus platinum gem, the atezo monotherapy, and the arm C of placebo plus platinum gem with a co-primary endpoint of PFS and OS. The post hoc analysis here was conducted in patients who did not have PD at week 18. And then those individuals, week 18 is sort of like when they got out of their chemo induction phase and went on to continue maintenance atezolizumab or placebo, or those that did have PD and thus did not continue on therapy. So we can see that subgroup analysis here for post-induction OS in patients with no PD. And there was a signal, here the hazard ratio for overall survival, 0.84, definitely crosses 1, but signal of sort of continuing maintenance therapy in those people without PD post-induction. And then they also did this analysis broken down by PD-L1 status, and those patients that had PD-L1 positive tumors did seem to derive benefit from continued, atezolizumab post-induction. And they even did a breakdown by type of chemotherapy. So the carboplatin-treated patients and the cisplatin-treated patients, and it seemed like those patients who were cis-eligible seemed to derive the most benefit from maintenance nivolumab post the induction therapy. And lastly, the post-progression OS in patients with PD by PD-L1 status really kind of these patients that have primary PD to platinum-based chemotherapy actually do quite poorly. You could see how low their overall survival, you know, is in the context of this study. So the next study to highlight is the phase two NORSE trial. This was a trial that looked at erdafitinib versus erdafitinib plus satralimab, which is a checkpoint inhibitor in patients with metastatic urothelial carcinoma with FGFR receptor alterations. These are the final results from the NORSE 2 study. And just to kind of give some background, we know that not all patients are eligible for cisplatin-based chemotherapy with metastatic UC. 50% of patients are actually ineligible. And the treatment options for those that are cis ineligible either include carboplatin-based regimens or right now, based off of data from EV-103 from cohort K, the combination of an anti-PD-1, you know, pembrolizumab plus EV. With regards to patients with actionable alterations, FGFR alterations can be observed in about 20% of patients that have metastatic or advanced UC. And there seems to be this interplay between FGFR alterations, which are enriched in luminal subtype 1, which have a lower likelihood of response to immunotherapy. You can see the data below of the single agent phase 2 study of erdafitinib, which is an oral selective pan FGFR TKI, and this agent was granted accelerated approval for treating FGFR altered advanced or metastatic UC. And here are the design of the phase two NORSE study, which looked at patients with metastatic UZ that were ineligible for cisplatinum. And this was looking at things in the frontline setting. So having received no prior therapy for metastatic or advanced disease, a little bit different from the prior study. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive erdafitinib versus erdafitinib plus satralimab with a primary endpoint of response. And there was a stratification based off of PD-L1 status. The study was designed to not actually conduct formal statistical comparisons between the arms, but rather kind of just have a background of what each of these regimens would do in the frontline setting. So the objective response rate with erdafitinib in frontline patients was 44%, with the combination with a checkpoint inhibitor, 54.5%. And then when we look at the progression-free survival, upwards of 11 months with the combination versus 5.6 months with erdafitinib alone, and overall survival, 20.8 months compared to 16.2 months. These are the medians. So definite signal, here demonstrating the activity of erda in the frontline population in selected patients who are cis ineligible. Then the next study to highlight is data that were presented by Dr. Gupta from EV-103 and looking at specific, there's multiple cohorts in this trial, but this was looking at the dose escalation cohort A. So this is the long-term outcomes of EV Pembro in this study. Just for a summary, this study had multiple different cohorts, but the patient population that was enrolled was patients with locally advanced or metastatic urothelial carcinoma cohort. The dose escalation looked at the combination of EV Pembro in cisplatinum ineligible frontline. That was 5 patients. And then the expansion of cohort A again looked at EV Pembro in the same cis eligible frontline population. And these were data that were, after median follow-up of 47 months that are presented here. And you could see the objective response rate, really respectable objective response rate of 73% with this combination and high concordance between independent and investigator assessed objective response rate. When we look at landmark PFS, 41.1% of patients were progression-free at 24 months into treatment, which is really quite impressive. And the median overall survival exceeded 2 years. There are associated treatment-related AEs with this regimen, from peripheral neuropathy, fatigue, some cytopenias, hyperglycemia to watch out for, rash, that are delineated here, but really quite an effective regimen. And it's now received accelerated approval by the FDA. We're eagerly awaiting the results of the phase 3 trial looking at this combination.
So just kind of curious if you would like to speculate on what would be seen if we did a trial comparing EV Pembro to standard, let's say, whatever people want to use, standard of care in younger patients, platinum eligible.
So that trial is currently being run. I don't know if the trial has completed accrual. I think one of the negative criticisms of that study is that the standard of care has changed for frontline treatment after the results of the Javelin bladder data getting presented. And the standard of care includes maintenance of avulumab, for those patients that receive frontline platinum-based therapy. So the trial does not allow checkpoint inhibitor maintenance in the control arm. So there's a little bit of criticism around that, but nonetheless, there is a frontline study that is actively ongoing looking at both cis and carbo, any platinum-based chemo, plus gem compared to EV Pembro.
So no, I want to see a trial comparing Javelin to EV Pembro. And yeah. I'm just curious, what you think a trial like that would show, both short-term and long-term. Because I assume short-term, maybe quality of life toxicity would be better with EV Pembro.
It could be. I mean, I think that, we have to keep in mind EV is a targeted chemotherapy in essence. It's, right. An antibody drug conjugate to Nectin-3. And I think that, there can be some of those same side effects that we see with chemotherapy, cytopenias, peripheral neuropathy, and other side effects. I think what's really impressive from some of the earlier studies is the durability of the regimen. And so I think, hopefully we'll see if this actually pans out in larger phase 3 trials.
Well, I mean, even the response rate, is it actually lower than chemo? I think it's higher, isn't it?
Indirectly. It's higher. No, it's higher.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
73% is like, this is gonna cause an upheaval for frontline treatment of bladder cancer if we, it's challenging, platinum-based chemotherapy, which has been queen, if you will, for a long time in the treatment of upfront bladder. So I think it's definitely gonna impact how people practice.
Really interesting. Okay, please continue.
All right. So the next study to present, kind of moving into the localized setting here, is data from the VESPER trial. This is overall survival at 5 years from this large European-based study that was conducted. And just to give a little bit of backdrop, so the VESPER trial is a trial that looked at perioperative dose-dense MVAC versus perioperative cisgem, and the trial actually was initially designed that either it could be neoadjuvant or adjuvant. And when the trial was initially designed, I think at the time most people were actually giving adjuvant therapy, though over time the field evolved and most of the treatment ended up being given in the neoadjuvant setting. The data for PFS at 3 years were presented at ESMO in 2021 and have since been published in the JCO. When you look at the overall cohort of all perioperative treatment, there was really no difference in the overall cohort. But if you specifically looked at the neoadjuvant group, that's where you saw a statistically significant improvement in 3-year progression-free survival with dose-dense MVAC versus GEMSIS. And so now what we're seeing here is the overall survival data at 5 years and the disease-specific survival. When you look at the overall cohort of both people that had received neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy, there was really no difference between the two groups. But if you looked at just the subgroup of patients who had received neoadjuvant therapy, receipt of dose-dense MVAC was associated with improved overall survival compared to patients who received GemCis. And so I think that this data are really quite impressive. I think that many view these data as potentially practice-changing, though the trial, technically the trial didn't meet its primary endpoint. But if you're looking at the subgroup of patients that received neoadjuvant therapy, those are the people that seem to really derive benefit from dose-dense MVAC. I mean, not everybody can receive dose-dense MVAC. I know, just thinking about fitness for dose-dense MVAC, but there definitely seems to be an improved benefit from an OS and disease-free specific survival standpoint. So those are kind of the key highlights from ASCO. You know, I'll highlight some additional data just from other approvals, highlighting relegolix. This is a LHRH antagonist. It's the first oral LHRH analog that is on the market. It has been associated with improved sustained castration rate. This is the data from the HERO trial that were presented by Dr. Shore, demonstrating that relegolix was associated with improved ability to suppress testosterone. Additionally, data from this study looked at testosterone recovery in people who had discontinued therapy, and treatment with relegolix was associated with a more rapid time to T recovery. And a post hoc analysis looked at cardiovascular events with this regimen, demonstrating that while cardiovascular events were low overall in patients with a history of MACE or a major, history of a cardiac event, the incidence of MACE was actually decreased with relegolix. So you can sort of see that data there. So this is certainly an opportunity for patients. We chatted a little bit about tivozanib. Tivozanib is a oral VEGF TKI with potent activity at the VEGF receptor. The results of the TiVo-3 trial really were what led to the approval of this agent entering the clinic. This was a trial designed for patients post-IO and post-VEGF. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to tivozanib versus sorafenib with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival, demonstrating that tivozanib was associated with improved overall or improved RPFS over sorafenib, and particularly in the subgroup of patients who had received both a prior VEGF and a prior IO, most of these received it sequentially as opposed to combination. The data, tivozanib was associated with improved RPFS. And so, this drug is approved. We talked about the TNEVO2 study, which is looking at Nevo plus tivozanib versus tivozanib alone in the post-IO setting. I think we're eagerly awaiting the results of that trial. And then lastly, XL092, which is a novel VEGF TKI, and this agent targets VEGF, MET, and also the immunosuppressive tumor microenvironment. There are several phase 1 trials. The STELLAR-001 trial is looking at XL092 in combination with atezolizumab or avulumab or as monotherapy, and STELLAR-002 is looking at 092 in combination with Nevo or Nevo Ipi in solid tumors. So I think we're going to be seeing some data, hopefully, about this agent, sanzilinatimab. I can't even say his name. I call it XL092. I can't even pronounce it.
How about Zanza?
Zanza's good. I like Zanza. Yeah.
All right. Well, I just have three more questions to ask you, okay? So just one question each for each of your main topics. So urothelial bladder cancer. My question is, any advice to people who are having problems accessing platinum agents in terms of managing bladder? What are you doing, or what do you recommend to people who can't get either carbo or cis? I mean, it seems like most people can get one, but just sort of theoretically, I'm not sure exactly what ASCO says. But what advice would you give somebody who cannot get either one?
You know, honestly, I think the EV approval couldn't have come at a better timing.
Right.
'Cause I think at a lot of institutions, they're restricting the use of platinums, particularly for patients that are being treated with a curative intent, and limiting use in the metastatic or advanced setting. But I think EV does open up the door as a frontline option for those patients that can't receive platinum or don't have access to platinum. And the data look, promising from an efficacy standpoint and a toxicity standpoint.
Yeah, that is really a great timing there. All right, second question for RCC. I'm sure you've heard this one a few times, but just kind of like to get your flavor of how you think through first-line therapy and metastatic disease. And in particular, do you have a favored IO-TKI combination?
Yeah, so very good question. I think whenever I have somebody who presents before me with metastatic disease, I always go through my mind, the first decision tree for me is, are they oligometastatic or polymetastatic? If they're oligometastatic, they have one or two sites of disease, everything else looks good, you know, maybe they've had their kidney removed some while ago and they've just got two or three spots, I'm thinking about a focal strategy, radiate or remove those agents, and then even considering adjuvant pembro. For those individuals that are polymetastatic that don't have the ability to undergo metastasis-directed therapy in some sort of way, the big question that I ask myself is, what is the pace of their disease? What's their burden of disease? What's their constitutional symptoms? If they have high tumor burden, hyperprogressor, I'm sort of worried about them. They've got a lot of constitutional symptoms. You know, sometimes with RCC, you know, people present with that, you know, night sweats, weight loss, that inflammatory triad, if you will. Those are people who I think, you know, I have to play the short game in. For those individuals that are not presenting in that kind of way, I'm playing the long game and generally favoring IO-IO. So, you know, I tell my patients, like, do we have to play the short game or do we have the luxury of playing the long game? And playing the short game means high upfront response rates, excellent PFS, but the data around long, long-term durability, treatment-free survival, you know, we don't have treatment-free survival data for IO-VEGF, where the entire regimen is discontinued, including the TKI. So that's sort of the decision tree that I make. For those people that need it up front, I'm favoring IO-VEGF. For those people that don't need immediate cytoreduction, I'm tending to favor IO-IO. And there's some situations where somebody's tumor burden may be low, but their tumor burden is in a position where you can't really afford growth. Like, you know, people that present with terrible bony metastases, and they've just got an area where it's encroaching on the spinal cord. They can't undergo resection. Like, you can't really afford a 1 in 5 PD rate, you know, especially if they're not a candidate for certain things that maybe you're leaning towards an IO-VEGF strategy. I think the IO-VEGF agents are probably more similar than they are dissimilar. I think getting a regimen, learning how to use it, learning how to dose titrate, dose modulate, and use it is probably going to be the best strategy. I like Nivo-Cabo because I think Nivo-Cabo is associated with improved quality of life. It's easy to titrate. And then it's very easy to use. I think the quality of life data also look pretty promising. But that's not to say, you know, in the context of somebody presenting with a locally advanced tumor and they're just locally advanced, unresectable, but they're not yet metastatic, but you think maybe you can get them to be metastatic, maybe you're leaning towards, you know, Len-Pem in that situation to really get them to get to a point where they could potentially be resected. So that's sort of how I think about it.
All right, one final question about prostate cancer. So my brain is still recovering from a webinar that we did with Neil Shore and Mary Ellen Taplin. And one of the topics we got into was biochemical recurrence. And one of the things you didn't present from the ASCO meeting, because it was presented at the AUA meeting a month before, I don't know why, it was like nothing presented at ASCO, yeah, was this amazing EMBARK study with biochemical recurrence that everybody, I think, at this point is pretty familiar with. But the subtleties of trying to manage biochemical recurrence, to me at this point, particularly with sort of EMBARK coming along, and now you've got the apalutamide study out there. The apalutamide study, they use continuous therapy. EMBARK, they use intermittent. Of course, EMBARK, they had this amazing enzalutamide monotherapy without ADT arm. So I'm just curious how sort of putting aside reimbursement and assuming that we'll be able to use all these things, particularly apalutamide and enzalutamide, in that space, How are you going to think through what to do and individualize it to patients in this very difficult situation?
Yeah. I hear you. It's quite challenging. And I would almost say that in the high-risk populations, every time we have added an ARSI, at least one ARSI, not two, but at least one ARSI, we have demonstrated improvements in outcomes. So in the MCRPC setting, we did it. In the MHPC setting, we did it. In the NMCRPC setting, we did it. In the localized high-risk stampede with Abby, right. We did it. In every single context where we have taken ADT and for a high-risk patient, escalated with an ARSI, pick your choice, we've improved outcomes for people. So I think there's going to be way more common use of these. It's going to become the new bicalutamide. We're going to get to the point where, like, you know, the ARSIs, whether it be Abby or Enza or APA, they're going to be the new bicalutamide where you just are escalating ADT with that agent, you know?
So what I was pointing out to them was that I think it's going to be the new tamoxifen where, you know, breast cancer, you add LHRH agonist, tamoxifen and AI. But, okay, so, I mean, I think, you know, we were talking, are there any times that you're going to use ADT alone anymore? And that seems to be a shrinking situation. It seems like almost every time you use ADT, you're going to add something, at least another hormone to it. But what about this issue of which agent, if you could choose between Enza and apalutamide, and also if you give apalutamide, are you going to give it continuously? If you give Enza, are you going to give it intermittently?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not in favor of a strategy of continuous ADT in the BCR setting. Because these people are going to live for a long, long time, you know, some decades on end, you know. So, you know, to be on continuous ADT, I mean, I would worry about, especially with an ARSI added on board, I would worry about alternate causes of, you know, mortality in these patients. You know, when we look at the prostate cancer specific mortality versus overall survival, there's a difference from EMBARK, you know. These patients are dying of things other than prostate cancer, not just prostate cancer, because there's a, you know, those curves don't overlap. So I think we just need to be really cognizant about the long-term consequences of these therapies. They're not inconsequential from a cardiovascular standpoint, bone health standpoint, quite honestly, just like quality of life. Like, patients don't want to stay on continuous ADT if they don't have to, you know?
So another question related to that is, if you're going to use intermittent therapy, I'm not a urologist, but I mean, it kind of seems like the antagonists are better to use because you get testosterone recovery quicker. Do you feel that way? Do you generally want to use that? Relagolix, if you could get it, would be perfect in a way, oral and an antagonist.
I think it's a double-edged sword, because I've had patients actually tell me two things around that. Like, you know, yeah, your T recovers faster, but probably your PSA recovery is going to be faster, or PSA rising is going to be faster, and then you're going to have to go back on hormone therapy again. So I think it could be a double-edged sword. I mean, it's where I think relagolix plays great is when you just want to use therapy, like you said, for a finite period of time. But I think we have to think about sort of what that could do to the PSA data once you discontinue. And then sort of what are going to be the trigger points for starting therapy again, like doing round two of the intermittent therapy, what that's going to look like for any given individual.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming there's going to be tons of data coming out of EMBARK, but probably a lot of other studies are going to help inform it. Okay, really final last question, which is, if you could, would you offer enzalutamide monotherapy without ADT? We know it looks like the hazard rates not as good as when you add, you know, Enza to ADT, but it still beat, you know, ADT alone. Is that something that you're going to bring up to men in this situation as an option?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the study wasn't really powered around that. And I would say that the study was not blinded in the Enza monotherapy cohort. So the other study, the comparison of enzalupron to lupron was a blinded analysis. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see the quality of life data. When you look at the AE data, it's not that much better with Enza. There's actually more cardiovascular tox, almost double with Enza. There's more cognitive issues, more falls. I think where you have less side effects is with the hot flashes. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see what the data looks like over time, but I don't necessarily think that Enza is eons better from a quality of life standpoint than ADT alone. But I mean, certainly for those individuals that, you know, are opposed to going on castration type therapy, it could be an option if you need to get their disease in check. Keep in mind, this was a high risk population with a PSA doubling time of less than 10 months, you know?
Yeah, I couldn't get Neil to tell us about the data he's presenting at ESMO because there's a lot of quality of life data, sexual functioning data.
Yeah.
But I mean, you tell me, what do you think they're going to see in terms of hot flashes and sexual function?
I mean, I think it's probably going to be better with Enza. And I think, again, quality of life has to be interpreted with caution in the context of the study because it was open label. Like, people knew they were only getting Enza monotherapy and weren't getting Lupron. Like, there's just something physiologic, like mental, psychologic about that, you know?
So, yeah, to be continued. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. McKay, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.